Good morning. Welcome to the July 24th, 2023 meeting of the Chelan Public Utilities Commission. We have four commissioners present today and our regular staff of manager Kirk Hudson, clerk of the board Rebecca Newman, and legal counsel Eric Walquist. I'd ask everybody to check their electronic devices to make sure they're placed in the silent mode to assist in not disrupting today's meeting. We do value public input at our meetings, and we'll be providing an opportunity for the public to have input at the end of our morning session and at the end of our afternoon session. If you wish to speak, we ask that you provide your name and address for the record so we have an accurate record of your input. We additionally ask that you limit your comments to 3 minutes. In addition, if you wish to speak to any of the specific agenda items today, I'll provide an opportunity for that at the end of each segment. And our flag salute and safety minute today will be brought to us by Cassie Bertelson.
All right. I pledge
allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty and justice for all.
All right. Well, thank you for having me again this morning.
I killed yourself. It.
We get it. Yeah. Sorry. Always throws me off. We're good. All right. Thank you. So as mentioned, I'm Cassie Bertelson. I'm the program manager for our human and organizational performance and strategy work over in the safety department. And I'm excited to be here with you this morning. Actually filling in as we had one of our IT folks was supposed to be given the safety minute today, but workload was high and she wasn't able to attend. So you get me today.
Yay.
thank you. So what I want to do today is just kind of give you a little bit of an insight into one of the topics that we're talking about at our safety meetings this month, and that is after action reviews. So an after action review is a type of organizational learning method that gets the team who perform work together to briefly discuss what was planned versus what was actually done and why. And why would we want to conduct an after action review? So the purpose of that is timely learning and improvement of how work is planned and executed. And that happens through the immediate transfer of knowledge of critical lessons, increased communication and feedback, and then that ultimately leads to better understanding of team performance. So when should we do an after-action review? Those we typically conduct after completion of tasks or activities or at the end of the day. So similar to how we'd conduct a pre-task planning meeting, it'd be conducted prior to beginning work, and after-action would be conducted right after work is complete and while those details are still fresh in the participants' mind. And that allows the group time to discuss some valuable insights, identify areas for improvement, and then enhance future performance based on those lessons learned. So how would we conduct an after-action review? There's a few questions that we would typically like to ask. So you'd start off by asking, what did we intend to do? What did we actually do? And what was different and why? And then once you kind of get through that, you can also ask, you know, what would we do differently next time? So those questions are intended to help learn about our system weaknesses, highlight surprises, as well as what went well, and then pinpoint any opportunities for improvement. And some tips for conducting an after-action review. Typically, we like those to be no more than like a 15, no more than 30-minute conversation. Make sure that everybody in the room's got an equal voice to be able to kind of share some of those lessons learned. So rank, seniority, experience should all be set aside. And then just make sure that you're encouraging those open conversations and active participation from everyone in the group and embrace the feedback received. So something that we're going to try and start doing here with not only our frontline folks, but we're recommending that leaders can also do it when you're making decisions as well. So just something to keep in mind. So any questions?
That was great. Questions, Commissioner?
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Love Thanks, your Cassie. Energy.
Yes.
Hey, Cassie, I have a question for you.
Oh, I thought
I was off. Right. Is your dad excited to retire?
He is very excited. He's getting a little bit of nervous, but a couple weeks left under his belt, and I think he just finished his last board meeting up there at the Leavenworth School District.
Cassie's father was my business manager when I was working, and he's a great guy. Thanks. So I'm very proud of him and happy for you. So.
I'll pass along the message. Thank you.
That was a question you had no problem
with. So, thank you again, Cassie. Commissioners, we have the agenda presented to us. It's time for the approval. Staff has recommended that we move resolution number 11 to the consent agenda. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the agenda will be modified as recommended, and we will move forward to the quarterly board balance scorecard status update. Now, Rebecca, you might need to help me out in how we decided to leave this with you doing a lot of the work. But before I turn it over to you, Rebecca and I had some conversations about this before the meeting, and while there's nothing dramatically different in the results here today, and we don't talk about those things that we're doing, that we're completing, just those that have not yet been completed, I did suggest to her that this is looking at some of the criteria that we have. I asked her to place it on our agenda for our board workshop coming up. Is that October?
October.
So we will be talking, I think, doing a little bit deeper dive than we've done on some of them. You know, there's two or three of them that I, when I really looked closely, I thought, is this what we really intended as a commission for our desired outcomes? So more to come. Now, what else were we supposed to do today, Rebecca?
So I will review your exceptions.
Okay.
And that came to me because I do prepare this report for you. And so I'm just going to present the information to you, and then you can discuss it or decide whatever
okay.
you want to do with
okay.
it.
Okay.
So you only had three exceptions on today's report, and they are down on page 2 under board representation. So we had the target for Northwest NWPPA and Northwest Public Power Association. That conference, the annual conference metric wasn't met because that conference was held in Alaska, and that makes travel just extra difficult for some folks to get there. So I think that's the reason there. As far as the Energy Northwest meeting, Commissioner Arsenault wasn't able to attend the first quarter because it conflicted with the Waputa meeting and his presidential duties there. And then at the regular board meetings, we're just shy of the target. There's been several personal and conferences and other conflicts that have all come together for that. So.
And as a matter of just a comment, two of those three items are items that I think we do need to talk about how we look at them at our board workshop, because I, for one, I'm not certain that a 60%, three commissioners at every NWPPA is the right target.
Yeah.
So anyway, well, more to come at our workshop.
Any questions?
Thanks, Rebecca.
Thank you very much.
The other thing I would just add is, I think it's important to look at these, but it's also important to look at the intent of these. And you know, the intent of these is active engagement, and the board has been very actively engaged. So even though, you know, these might be exceptions, there's a lot of stuff that isn't on here that doesn't illustrate the active involvement that you all have in different associations and meetings. So.
Okay.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. All right. So now for the main event of the morning, rate 3536.
Yep. I'd like to invite Lindsay.
Did you have a good weekend in anticipation of it?
Always on my mind. Good morning, Commissioners. Lindsay Mons, Business Manager and Customer Utilities. I'm here representing a large group of folks that put in a great deal of effort on this project. After listening to Cassie this morning, perhaps we call it an after-action review. So we took a look at what we did and how it's working and what we should do going forward. So this is the high-density load cryptocurrency rate review and proposal. This really came about following several substantial annual increases in the effective energy rate for the Rate 36 cryptocurrency customers and some associated customer comment that came in following those plans and forecasts. And the board requested us to take a look at that rate and the methodology and see if it was doing what we intended it to do. And I'd say while we do continue to believe that the rates that are in place right now do do what we intended them to do, we do also recognize that we have some customers that, you know, are kind of in between a rate 35 and 36. Their loads have been very stable, which is a little bit different than the general cryptocurrency as a whole. So today we bring to you another option for discussion associated with this these rate groups.
Lindsay, would you help me understand the difference between high-density load and cryptocurrency?
Yes. Can I hold that question?
Yes.
See if we get there? Okay. So just this is a lot of words for background. I'm not going to go through each and every one of them, but just in general, in 2022, we saw our first big increase in the cryptocurrency market rate. It went from a 5.64 cents a kilowatt hour up to a 7.89 cents a kilowatt hour, which was intended to be effective in April, April 1st of 2022. April is our annual increase for those. But recognizing that increase, the board did defer that to June 1st, which is in line with all our other rates. So in addition to allowing time to discuss, it did put it in line with other rate schedules. Following that, going into the next year, we saw an additional significant increase in the forecast up to 13.61 cents a kilowatt hour, which was set for April of 2023. So within that time period, the board approved some transition contracts for customers. And eventually we have deferred that April 2023 increase now until August 1st. So that's where we currently sit right now. We've got some contracts in place and potentially an increase on August 1st. But going today into the results of our review and the option there. So the proposal summary from staff was to revise, and I'll go into more detail on each of these bullets in the next few slides, but first to revise the rate 35 and rate 36 class applicability, update the rate 36 energy charge calculation, and to implement some risk mitigation measures for both distribution system operations as well as financial stability or sustainability. So looking at the two different rate classes and what is a cryptocurrency versus a high density load, Commissioner Allen, rate 35, which was high density load, is currently applicable to server farms and similar technological operations with energy use intensity of 250 kilowatt hours per square foot per year. So what that says to us, that energy use intensity, is that there's a high amount of power that's pretty stable, so all on all the time in a fairly low footprint. And the risk to our system there is that our substations are built with some assumptions associated with, you know, how much service area it can cover, what sort of variability of the load on a daily basis and a seasonal basis those substations see. But when the high density loads and cryptocurrency being similar, change the way our substations have to operate because they are all on all the time. So currently rate 35 is that server farm and technological operations. We're recommending or proposing that we change that applicability to just be any energy intense use of up to 250 or sorry, energy intense use of 250 square kilowatt hours per square foot per year or more that aren't covered by a more specific rate schedule. And that more specific rate schedule in this case would now be rate 36, which is currently applicable to the cryptocurrency services, but we would expand that to be applicable to all data center and similar computing loads up to that 3 megawatts. So one of the key questions the board asked us when we were working on this is what, from our electrical system side, do they really look different? Does the data center look different than a cryptocurrency customer? And this reflects the answer to that question is no, they do look the same on our system. So we're proposing to combine those two classes together or two types of use together.
Can we just stop and say, does that answer your question?
Yeah, and thank you, because I had read this. I want you to know I did read, but hearing it is much better.
Absolutely.
And I actually, my note was to provide an example, but I don't think I need.
Okay. If you have more questions later, just
The way I think about it, I don't know whether it'll help you or not, is that the rate 36, those could more likely than not fit in rate 35. It's a subset of rate 35, and that subset just is pulled out more specifically because it has its own set of, I'll say, risks and opportunities that we're trying to address.
Thank you. So looking at this class applicability adjustment, as far as our current customers go, we'd have 7 services that would fall under this new definition of rate 36. And those 7 services have a total authorized load of just about 9 megawatts. We have 1 application currently under review, and that application would add another 0.5 megawatt, making the class total 9.5 megawatts. So that's a key number as we move forward into the next slides. As far as rate 35 and 36 cost recovery go, or rates as we also refer to them, on the rate 35 high density load rates, we're proposing no changes there. The only change in rate 35 that we're talking about today was that applicability slide that we just covered. The rates themselves will continue with the cost of production energy, no change to demand charge, monthly customer charge, or upfront capital. That would all stay the same. Rate 36, which would be data centers and similar loads. Again, no change in the basic in demand or upfront capital charge. So those stay the same. And there is an appendix slide that has those detailed out for anyone interested or anyone listening to this later. The change in rate 36 is in the energy charge and how we calculate the monthly energy rate. So for class sizes of up to 10 megawatts, which covers the entire load that we're holding right now or serving right now, we would allocate a cost of production rate for a total class of up to 10 megawatts. As or if that class were to grow, that brings in additional risk to the district. Those are new customers that we haven't experienced before as far as load stability goes. And if that total load or when that total load goes over 10 megawatts authorized, it would become a blended rate proportionately of cost of production and market together. And we'll talk more about that. So looking at this in a table, total authorized load of 10,000 kilowatts or 10 megawatts, those are one and the same, 1,000 kilowatts per megawatt. For that first or that class being 10 megawatts or less, the energy charge would be 3.04 cents a kilowatt hour. That's currently equivalent to rate 35 and would increase next June with the normal rate schedule that the boards previously adopted. When the total authorized load goes over 10 megawatts, we start to talk about the blending component. So we'd have the 3.04 cents a kilowatt hour for 10,000 kilowatts plus proportionately and market energy charge for that amount over 10. So looking at the example, yes.
Would that, when you hit the 10 megawatt, is that for the new customers coming on, or does that then impact everybody in that class?
Great question. Yes, that does impact everyone in the class. So rates have to be applied on the class as a whole. So as the class size grows, the rate would also grow with that.
Okay. I'm going to keep thinking about that.
Okay.
So we aren't able to grandfather within classes. There's super difficult to say I had 10 of you on system, you're number 11, you caused us to go buy more power, so I'm going to only charge you that incremental difference. There's pretty good case authority that that is a non-starter discussion.
But then, okay, those people already in the class that then get hit with those extra charges because it's gone over, then they're going to say, that's not fair, or?
I don't know what they'll say. That's certainly a possibility. That's,
okay. I'm okay.
So think of it a little bit differently. Think about grandfathering rates for the first residential customers that help set up the projects. And we would say every new customer on has a new rate. Yeah. Because you're incrementally increasing our cost.
Gotcha. Okay.
I like to think of this, too, as the element that we're talking about here is there's a volumetric risk that you have a volume of loads above this 10 megawatts, and that introduces new risks to the system, and that then the rate is adjusted accordingly for that, where here the rate is based mostly on production with the energy component, market energy component. You know, they're actually getting perhaps a better rate as long, because it reflects a lower volume risk to the district. And so then once that volume increases, it's a higher risk that has to be recovered.
Thank you.
Okay. So for the example here at the bottom of the table, just talking about the proportionality here. So if we had a 15,000 kilowatt authorized load, the 10 megawatts of that would be at 3.04 cents, 5 megawatts would be at the market energy charge, and then we would average it together for the whole class. I'll talk about market energy charge here next, but do we have any questions on the proportionality piece? So the market energy charge, similar to existing rate 36, is calculated based on the on and off peak futures in the market on the ICE, Intercontinental Exchange. There's a 6% administrative cost and a 3.1 cent kilowatt hour charge for other energy charges. Those are all similar to the existing rate. So as far as calculation goes, we're same as we talked about with cryptocurrency. This we've adjusted the effective date of this increase from what used to be the April 1st date to a June 1st date to align with all of our other rates. So we would set this rate in February, and then in June would be applicable. So if we were looking at this year, February 1st of 2023, calculating this based on the methodology here, it would be 12 cents a kilowatt hour effective. Or until from now until May 31st, 2024. If we were to be looking at that 15 megawatt class size as the example, the 10 megawatts at 3.04 cents, 5 megawatts at 12 cents, the effective rate or the blended energy rate for the entire class would be 6.03 cents.
So it if we're at 10 and that new load that came on was 2 megawatts, it would be a substantially smaller spike.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep.
Yep. And we will set this annually unless we have a huge increase. We do have the way the proposed rate schedule is drafted. If it was to be a big increase, we might have to look at a mid-year change, but normally we would set this rate annually, so we'd look at that class size annually to be able to give those customers, existing customers and new customers, some forecast as far as what the rate will be in and increases.
There's the fare component.
Okay, moving on to risk mitigations. So on the operating system, the distribution and transmission system together there being the delivery system, we'd continue with our existing availability limited to certain areas of our county. So right now, high density or cryptocurrency loads aren't allowed past Leavenworth because of the transmission line capabilities in that area. And the upfront capital charges adjust based on if you're located in the Wenatchee Corps versus beyond, say, Chelan. So those all continue to remain the same to support the operating systems. What's new with this rate is that this would have a substation capacity limit. So new loads in rate 35 or 36, sorry, in rate 36 would not be authorized when they exceed 70% of the substation design capacity. They could go up to that, but not beyond. And then each individual substation would not carry more than 3 megawatts of high density load or cryptocurrency or combined. And the other new item here, while the district does have interruptibility authority within our service area, these customers would have priority interruptibility. What that means really is if we have a substation, for instance, that's seeing a peaking situation, say in the middle of winter or in the heat of summer, that could cause the whole substation to go offline, these would be the first customers that we would take down from power or last to restore to make sure that we can maintain that reliability of the substation.
I have a question.
Yes.
So in the event that substation growth does exceed 3 megawatts just because of organic growth, what happens to that portion above the 3 megawatts?
This would be just this load type can't exceed 3 megawatts on that substation. So the rest of the substation may be far more than 3 megawatts, but this particular load class type.
So I guess that's my question is, what happens if this particular load type has organic growth, internal organic growth, can it exceed 3 megawatts?
So each of these customers have an authorized maximum limit, and they would have to apply to increase their limit. And if that, we wouldn't authorize an application that exceeded 3 megawatts.
Okay.
Does that help?
I'm a little foggy on that one.
So what do you mean by organic growth?
So if their business model and their just daily operations grow. Oh,
for one customer?
From one customer.
Yeah, so that's I think where Lindsay was getting is, so these customers are required to make application, tell us what their load is going to look like, the ramp rate. We have to approve those before they will be turned on. And so we would not allow, and we presently have those limits with our customers on system now, and we do not allow them to exceed those service levels, period, without a new application explaining the need and why and having that approved based upon a new system review at the time.
Is there a governor or something that prevents them from?
John Stoll and I.
Thank you, Kelly. That was exactly my question.
So we do as a district monitor that usage, in fact, pretty carefully. And when we see those exceedances, then we usually reach out to the customer, remind them of that, tell them what we're seeing on system. Sometimes they don't have the same capabilities we do. And if it's required, we have a meeting. We sit down with them and explain the challenges that we face, listen to what their concerns are. And then if there's a path forward, whether that's a new application or something, we would provide that as an alternative for them.
There is also a demand exceedance charge that the customer experiences in those situations for the additional pressure it puts on our system.
Right, and our ultimate leverage is we will turn you down, right? There, we will stop your service, but we've, as in all cases, go extra lengths to make sure we aren't doing that, which is why I said John and I, we always reach out first to make sure that we understand one another, what's happening. Could be just a blip, could be something, an anomaly. Don't want to shut anybody off though without having those conversations. So if my guess is if we continued to see behavior or consumption that was out of line with the agreement that we had, we would consider that. We certainly have that authority.
If you see Andy Wendell over there twitching, that's probably an early warning where we're getting up against the limits.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. We should say that it is the operating group that brought these limits to us. We didn't create them out of whole cloth. We actually went through that conversation.
But it does formalize the need for good communication with us so that we are operating a reliable, dependable system.
Correct.
Okay. And our customers are good about that. Yeah. So. Financial risk mitigation, as I mentioned, upfront capital charges remain in that area as well. Some adjustments here are, I think, what the industry would term as a take-or-pay situation. So the next two bullets on demand and energy, our demand charges would be billed to our customers monthly at that maximum amount. So whatever they're authorized to use and that we're holding for them in capacity, they would be billed for on a monthly basis. Or if in the situation we just discussed, if they exceeded their demand, they would be billed at that higher amount. So whichever is greater.
Question.
Yes.
At that higher amount.
So if they were contracted and we authorized 2 megawatts, for example, but they had a number of days or a month or so where they operated at 2.1 megawatts. That's the exceedance charge, the demand exceedance charge. They would be charged a little bit higher for that last 0.1.
Where does that higher number come from? What is the higher amount?
It's specified in the rate schedules. I want to say it's either 2 or 3 times the current demand charge.
Okay.
And I believe it's on a daily basis as well. So it would add up quite quickly.
Okay.
So we can take that, though, and I'll follow up.
Yeah.
And then on the energy side, billed at the greater of the actual energy used or 90% of the authorized energy. So if you think about a kilowatt, when you translate that into kilowatt hours, if they were to be using their full service at maximum capacity, that would be on average 720 kilowatt hours. 90% of that would be 648 kilowatt hours. So for a 1 kilowatt service, if they were operating at 600 kilowatt hours, they would be billed that 648, which is the 90%. But if they were operating at 700 kilowatt hours, they would be billed at 700 because that's the greater of the two. So I probably made that really confusing, mm-hmm. throwing in numbers that weren't on the slide, but just talking about what that 90% means. So are they using their service to at least 90%? That's what we're reserving for them. So that's the billing component there. And then security deposits, new customers coming on. In particular, the security deposit would be 3 times the projected monthly bill there. So that protects the district for non-payment, late payment, things like that, where we're holding credit because we do bill in arrears. So customers have used their service and sometimes can get out a couple months before we get to the point of disconnection of services. So that puts us at a financial risk there as well. So at this point, that is a summary. That is the proposal from staff. If you have any questions or discussions, we can have that now. I do have a couple more slides on next steps if you would like us to continue down this path, or if you would like us to consider some other things. Now's the opportunity.
Commissioners, any questions? I have a question. I actually have 2 questions. And I lost the first one. I know the second one, though. One of the things I noticed as we started this conversation, there's a number of people in the room today that are not as often in the room as that they're here today. You mentioned you had a large team. Who's on your team?
Oh my gosh.
Oh.
Who's not? Are you pulling up the list?
I was working on it.
Charles, Andy, myself, Mark Mullins, Brett Hammond, Janet, Jaspers and EP&T and Mike Bradshaw there.
Okay, I have
Kathy Melton.
Want me up? So it's just the rate 3016. I'll test you. Keep going. So I'll just run through them. So okay. We have, whoops. And then I lost it, of course. Come on. We need Ian here for my help with this. Yeah. There we are. Andy Wendell. Let's see, Brandon Carnahan, Brett Hammond, Kathy Melton, Chad Bowman, Chad Risman, Charles Von Reese, Dan Garrison, Daniel Apple, me, Janet Jaspers, Jamie Mitchell, Lindsay here, Martin Mullins, Mike Bradshaw, Lisa's been on, and then I would say we've also drawn on the expertise of a fairly large contingent of non-identified subject matter experts when we have questions we need to reach out to and test something on.
Lyle Moore was very helpful.
Yeah, Lyle is a great example of that from the perspective of handling those questions and answers with customers. So we've had, this is the team that's on initially started. I would say that's grown over time.
So how was it herding cats?
Eric was the cat herder.
I do recall the other question I had that just popped into my brain, and maybe it's nothing. You have a customer that for whatever reasons in a given billing cycle drops down to 50% or 40%, what does that do? I mean, do they get a 90% bill?
Yeah.
So that their bill does not go down?
That's part of you know, as we plan our system, both on the distribution side and save that capacity on the substation for them, and in our daily, monthly, hourly energy planning, we plan for them to be at that 100%. So the cost that we're incurring is that full 90 to 100% charge there on the energy as well. So that is what we bill.
And they set that. So we work with the customers to get their approved levels.
Yeah.
So they will know that up front, and it will become part of the application, their consent to that.
Is that a pretty flexible communication between customer and utility on how rapidly, I mean, if they see their need to change, does that occur fairly rapidly? Or
we actually haven't had really any that have changed in real time like that. You know, they once they're running, they're running. We have had some that have come offline, and this could change how a customer comes offline. We do ask that they give us 60 days notice within this rate schedule as well for that.
Great.
Thank I would you. Say that's the time, 60 days. And then I agree with Lindsay. If the pricing goes down for whatever the particular commodity currency they're mining, then we do see drop-offs, but not, say, mostly we see drop-aways, they leave town.
Yeah.
So at this point, before you go to your next slides, if there's no more, Gary.
I have a comment, actually, not necessarily a question. As just reflecting back to when we implemented Rate 35, and during that, I'm going to call it a scary period of time when we had crypto was extremely popular. There were very transient loads, talk within the industry of crypto miners fleeing in the darkness of night, leaving utilities with large bills unpaid. And I recall a meeting that we had up at the CTC where at that moment in time, Alcoa had announced they were closing down. And the crypto miners were assuring us that they were going to employ these former Alcoa workers and pay them on a scale the same as what they were making at Alcoa and provide them with 401ks and retirement packages. And then we fast forward to today, and we see many of those crypto miners are not in our community any longer. It's yet to be seen whether or not their 401ks will match what Alcoa was paying. I just think of our staff here and the measures that we took at Chelan PUD, and I only have a measuring stick that looks across the river and down the river, and I see other mid-seas that were not as quick, I think, to put a moratorium in place to study the impacts to the system as Chelan was. And I have to tell you, I'm really proud of Chelan. Proud of the staff, proud of the measures that were taken, the fact that we said, wait a minute, time out, let's go into a moratorium, let's look at this. And there's probably a couple of meetings at Waputo where some other commissioner from another PUD doesn't bring it up, but more often than not, the commissioners around the state are like, boy, you guys did it right. You didn't allow this to get out of control. And so I look at us here today talking about now Rate 36, and I see this as really a refinement, finessing Rate 35. We now have taken time, studied the impacts of this type of load on our system, and we're refining what we did so many years ago with Rate 35. To me, it makes perfect sense, and once again, I'm very proud of all the staff that spent countless hours to come together with this proposal to bring it to us. It shows that we're continuing to work on this. And I'm going to say I'm pretty sure that once this rolls out and give it a few months, there will be commissioners at Waputo that will once again come up and say, congratulations, you guys, because you're not sleeping on your laurels. You're continuing to refine this and making it better for everyone, not just the district. Of course, we're putting risk mitigation in place, but we're also making it better for our customers. And that's really very important. So I just want to take this moment and just say thanks to staff for really bird-dogging this thing. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
We'll pass that on. Thank you.
Well said, Gary.
And then along those lines, I'm curious, because crypto, it came about, it was like a new trend. And now as we're moving into the future with electrification and looking at more commercial fleets, is there a conversation about having different rate schedules for those impacts that might be coming down the pipe?
We do have an EV charging rate schedule for those level 3 chargers that are publicly available.
You're already ahead of me. Awesome.
As far as fleets go, I know there are some conversations underway. I don't want to overstep anything there.
Yeah. But I can say that is on our list for this year. Is one of our goals is to better understand where these large fleet conversions might happen. We've been focused on more of the residential and piece and getting our arms around that, but this year we are trying to get our arms around the larger fleets and understanding that presents a significant challenge for our distribution system if that happens too fast.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It would be easy to envision fleets being electrified first with, I think about UPS and FedEx and some of those types
school
of
districts.
School districts.
Yep.
Link is already going down that road.
Yeah. Other public agencies.
Yes. Any other questions before we let Lindsay get to her last couple of slides? I think I recognize everybody in the room, but this is one of those topics that I want to open the floor to the public if there's any public or anybody here that wants to comment on what's been presented. Okay. Thank you.
All right. So next steps. This would be our proposed rate outreach plan. So with any rate changes or new rates or anything else, we go through a pretty formal process involving the public. So today was our preview. We would go into a public notice period where we're informing the public via newspaper and otherwise that we are proposing rate changes here. And we'd have a formal rate hearing inviting customers in and to comment on the next board meeting. Is just the way this is formatted. Of course, we can adjust and change this per the board schedules or desire. But that next board meeting would be August 7th for that public comment. And then the next board meeting after that, if we do continue, would be August 21st. So that's the quickest we could bring a proposal or a resolution seeking adoption for this. The board has flexibility there to make those periods longer. Moving into this, recognizing that the deferral of the rate 36 energy charge was till August 1st. The next slide you'll see, we would propose a motion to extend that out to October. October being a date just because, you know, if these public hearings bring forth information that we need to further research from the public or other questions that the board might have if this schedule were to reach out a little bit before we bring resolution, we are looking for that flexibility in that. So this would be the motion if it's of interest to you.
So is this is a motion that's needed today because August 1 is our implementation period. Yep.
That's correct.
And that can be done during the study.
You can do it right now.
We can do it right now.
I propose to further defer the 2023 annual adjustment of the rate schedule 36 market energy charge to October 3, 2023 to allow time to complete the consideration and potential modification of rate schedule 36.
Motion has been made. Is there a second?
Second?
And I was worried there for a minute.
Don't get too comfortable yet.
The motion is made and seconded. Is there any discussion of the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
I just want to point out one more time, just so that everyone's aware that we will begin public notice tomorrow, unless you'd want us to wait at all. But if we're comfortable and ready, you'll start seeing that out there. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Lindsay.
Thank you and team.
Want us to just continue down the normal agenda?
Yep, that'd be great.
Okay. Commissioners, our next item on our agenda is our consent agenda. Is there a motion to approve the consent agenda, which has been modified to include Resolution 11?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda, including Resolution 11. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. Regular agenda, item 8.
Okay, I'll invite Larry Cordes up. Resolution 8 is a resolution authorizing amendment number 5 to service agreement number 19-086 with Mead and Hunt Incorporated to provide Lake Chelan Dam Power Tunnel Isolation System Engineering Services. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Larry Cordes. I'm in the Dam Safety Group. I'm a civil engineer with the district. I'm the project manager for the Power Tunnel Isolation System project. So, a little bit of background on the project, and you might see it in your budget listed as the Lake Chelan Seismic Study Auto Closure Gate. The agreement with Mead and Hunt is titles it the Power Tunnel Isolation System Project, and that's what we will advertise it as. Excuse me. A little bit of background on the project. The intent of the project is to replace the stop logs at the inlet to the power tunnel at Lake Chelan Dam. And we'll replace the stop logs with a electrically operated gate. A little bit of background, too. The project was ready to bid early 2022. And at that time, FERC requested some additional analyses. And those additional analyses led to additional seismic analyses, and which led to additional seismic load requirements on the structure. So, since that time, about a year and a half ago, we've been working with Mead and Hunt to evaluate several alternatives to beef up the structure to address the additional seismic loads. The resolution before you essentially provides for that additional design effort, and it also provides the remaining funds needed to get the project out to bid. And we're hoping to put the project out to bid in September or October of this year. So I wanted to stop there and maybe just ask if there's any questions on the project concept.
You might just describe the difference between the current stop log, what it takes to put those in place versus what you're proposing to do here for this.
Sure, yep. Right now, to shut off the power tunnel at the inlet up at the Lake Chelan Dam, it's three or four stop logs that we have to install with a crane and a crew. Excuse me, let's get a little closer here. But a lot of mobilization effort entailed, a lot of time. This project will replace that stop log configuration with an electrically operated gate so that it can be done, you know, in minutes rather than hours and days preparation. So there's a safety benefit in that. There's an operational benefit. So it's a good project. So, but we have been wrestling with the design issues here in the last year and a half. Had it real close to ready to bid, but ran into some design challenges. So
could you refresh my memory? So there's like almost a trolley type thing, is that right, that moves the gate?
Well,
shall I show you the picture?
Sure. Yeah. That's the mule.
Okay.
So the mule operates the Tainer gates, four of the eight Tainer gates.
Okay. And will that be replaced, removed? Is that
no.
part of the project at all?
No, oh. no. So this project, the tunnel that runs, you know, roughly 2 miles down to the powerhouse.
Is it the penstock?
penstock.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
A portion of the tunnel that's called the penstock, and then the tunnel itself is the tunnel. This project replaces the stop logs that are at the inlet to the power tunnel with a gate.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I was at the wrong location. Wrong end.
You were within.
Don't tell everybody.
Tens of feet location wise. So, yeah.
Gary, did you have a question?
Just in terms of understanding this and comparing it to the hydro system on the river, would this be the equivalent of a wicket gate?
No.
No.
No, this would be similar to the types of spillway gates we have at Rock Island Dam.
Okay.
Meaning there was going to be a hoist setting above the gate that would drop it into the in front of the power tunnel and close the power tunnel off. The one change that we've has kind of come about due to these seismic load changes is that the hoist that sat above the gate is now going to sit on the deck and will have ropes going up and over pulleys to open and close the gate.
And it'll be one panel as opposed to, you say currently it's three, it'll be one.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Great. Thank you.
Welcome.
Seems like a good system.
Yeah.
So once you go out to bid, what do you anticipate the time frame to be?
Yeah, the key to the project is it has to coincide with a tunnel outage, a scheduled tunnel outage. We had hopes that that could happen in April of 2024, next spring. But due to equipment lead times and this design delay, we're going to push that out to 2025. So we're going to do all the work we can do next construction season, 2024, get our equipment ordered, get our gate fabricated. Then we'll be set up to do that 2025 work that needs to be done while the tunnel's out of commission. So, and be buttoned up roughly July of 2025 is our goal. So,
yeah.
Will that take the system offline?
That during that outage? Yes. Yeah, it would be part of the scheduled outages that occur periodically for Lake Chelan, for Lake Chelan units A1 and A2.
A question, Commissioner McKenna?
Well, I've looked in that tunnel one time. I didn't go down into it, but during one outage, how often does that occur? Those scheduled, I just can't recall. Is it periodic or is it scheduled maintenance? Or I just can't remember.
Yeah, I'm not sure how often. I know they always happen during the April time frame.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we just did one here this spring, this April 2023. We had one arranged for April 2024 to accommodate this project. I don't know if that April 2024 will still happen for other reasons. And we're going to get on the books for April 2025.
Got it.
So it's always an April time frame and then kind of based on need. So
thank you. Yeah.
Any other questions? My turn. Mine is completely off the wall, and it may require Willard Fields to answer. I don't know. An old-timer shared with me that up at Chelan, there was a second tunnel.
Yeah.
It's padlocked off, but that was designed for additional power generation. Is that correct?
That's correct, and that tunnel is just hundreds of feet long in the vicinity of the dam, and it's now used as the low-level outlet. It's what maintains the minimum flows in Chelan Gorge. So that tunnel's used that way.
Okay, but it doesn't go all the way down the hill.
Correct.
There's a spot at the powerhouse, too, for that to come in, but that's it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that was, the initial thought was a second tunnel all the way down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
so there is a coming attraction, meaning that because of the delays we've encountered tackling these design issues, we haven't got out to bid as soon as we'd hoped. our construction costs have escalated. So I'm planning to be back in about a month with a budget revision so that we can get our budget shaped up and put the project out to bid in September or October. So I will be back with, and that presentation will include some more detailed graphics and such that will give you a little better picture.
Thank you.
What the project will do.
So. Great.
Awesome.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Larry.
You're welcome.
Okay, I'd like to invite Toby up for the next two. Agenda item number 9 is a resolution ratifying field work order change orders number 7, 8, and 9 and approving field work order change order number 10 to contract 19-72 with Rayfield Brothers Excavating for unit price excavation services. Welcome, Toby.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Toby. I'm with the EPM group here at headquarters. With Chad and Court. Again, today, we're here for a resolution to increase the not-to-exceed contract amount for Rayfield's excavation service. We've been using them to replace underground faulting cables as part of our fire mitigation pieces there. We also have fire season in our midst and a winter storm season ahead of us. They've also been part of our solutions to address those needs as well when we keep them on contract. Currently, we don't have the funds to keep them in place through the end of the year, so we're here to address that. And we're projecting $750,000 with $250,000 kind of contingent to support those fire and winter storm potentials. So that is our amount. We propose about $500,000 to get to the end of the year. Rayfield's contract, this excavation contract, concludes and is complete at the end of this year. We are in the process of rewriting a contract to put that out to bid for continued excavation services next year, but there is no more extension of this term under this contract. December 31st is it.
Any questions? Thank you.
He's going to take the next one, too. Agenda item number 10 is a resolution ratifying field work order change orders number 1 through 5 and approving field work order change order number 6 to contract 21-17A with Batcheller Excavation LLC for unit price trenching.
Thank you. This contract is very similar in scope. They do excavation services to support our distribution and fiber installs in the Chelan-Manson area. They recently have been used to support the substation and feeder getaways development at the North Shore substation, which used considerable resources from their contract. So we're looking to replenish that, get them on pace to get the money back to finish out this year's term, add an additional term for next year's services, and then fund that term as well. And that total comes to $1.2 million. To extend through November of 2024.
So the increase is $500,000.
That was a previous amount that we increased earlier during the term. The increase today is that we're asking for is 1.2. So they are on track to do about $600,000 a year. So we have $600,000 set aside for next year. We have to replenish. I think that's $500,000 we've used on the substation itself, and then there's another $300,000-$400,000 remaining this year to bring that total to $1.2 million.
For clarity, commissioners, we give you've delegated under the delegation resolution the first $500,000 and change to Kirk, so that's why the first $500,000 didn't come before the board.
Okay. Gotcha. Any questions, commissioners?
I feel like I need to recuse myself on this one due to having a relationship with Batcheller in my personal business.
Okay.
I would say both these contracts are really beneficial in order for us to, as you can imagine, you know, you could hear what Toby was describing. They're used all across the district for different divisions and work that happens. And so if we have a need, we're able to pick up the phone, call them, get them out there. And Toby is one that's representing all areas of the district in terms of these two contracts. So I appreciate him doing this. It's I know he has some support, but it, sometimes there's a lot of work that goes into tracking all the work that's being done on these contracts and the limits to make sure that come before and not exceed those. So appreciate your work on that, Toby.
Thank you.
So you probably want to take item 10 separately.
Yeah, and that was my next thought. If there's no more questions, I wonder if we shouldn't act on resolution number 10 right now. Commissioner Allen recusing herself, so... Is there a motion to approve Resolution 10?
I would make such a motion.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve Resolution 10. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? And Commissioner Allen, should be noted, has recused herself. Okay.
Thanks, Toby.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Agenda item 12 is a resolution amending and restating the electric line extension policy. I'll invite Sarah and Lyle up as I'm reading this. And the water and wastewater line extension policy portions of the district's utility service policies. Sarah and Lyle have been here the last two meetings, and so they now have a resolution prepared for amending those line extension policies for your consideration.
Good morning, Commissioners. Sarah Delosier, Customer Service Operations and Dispatch Supervisor.
Lyle Moore, Supervisor for Customer Service Engineering.
As Kirk stated, today we are here seeking approval for a resolution amending and restating the electric and water and wastewater line extension policies. We have been here at the previous two board meetings, June 26th and July 10th, my birthday. And while we had quite a bit of comments from customers previously, we have not received any public comment since those board meetings. So today we are asking to revise the policy with the intent to better align the policy with practices, mitigate risk, provide clarity to our customers, and improve the customer satisfaction through a phase change approach. We have two phases. One, effective immediately if supported, would remove the property ineligibility language and would maintain that existing policy, including revisions stated within the resolution for applications accepted on or before December 31st of 2023. The phase two approach would begin on January 1st of 2024. It would establish residential single lot eligibility, also establish a reimbursement term to 4 years, establish a minimum project threshold of $15,000, limit subsequent payouts to two, limit reimbursement to PUD originated costs, so the estimated line extension costs, and also offset amounts to pay off any utility account unpaid delinquent balances, so those are that are moving towards the collection process. Again, that phase two revisions would be applicable to new eligible line extension applications accepted on or after January 1st of 2024. Again, we're here today seeking approval. With this, we are committed to checking in within 4 years, if approved, to provide feedback on the changes of this phased approach and provide any additional recommendations if determined. Did I miss anything?
Very good.
Do you have any questions?
Commissioners, any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good rundown. Good recap. Thank you.
You betcha.
Yeah. So, Commissioners, we have resolutions 8, 9, and 12 before us that need a motion for approval. Is there such a motion?
So move.
Is there a second?
I'll be a second.
Been moved and seconded to approve resolutions 8, 9, and 12. And seconded. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried.
Thank you both.
Have a great
day. We let Lyle off pretty easy. On
this. I'm here. He owes you one, Sarah.
manager items.
Okay, I've got two items here. I'd like to invite Bob Shane up to talk about the fiber swap agreement.
Good morning, Commissioners. Bob Shane, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom Group. Recently, there was an article posted in Wenatchee World about an infrastructure exchange agreement that we have with Douglas County PD. I thought this would be a great time to explain the purpose of that and the value and benefit. Back in 2001, when we first started the fiber program, it was recognized that we might have a need to use each other's fibers in some applications and services, and so we started this infrastructure exchange agreement back at that time. Had a 20-year term. It expired. We missed that, and we'll have to come back and extend that contract or start another agreement, but it's identical to what we did for the past 20 years. And specifically, to give you some ideas of what that is, for operational excellence, for example, we like to have redundancy up to the Chelan area. And right now we have two paths. We have our own path on Chelan County to serve customers up there. We also lease fibers on the Douglas County side as a part of the resiliency that goes up on their transmission distribution lines to provide that same service. So if there's an outage on either side, we have some resiliency. And what we do on that is we take those rates and the fiber distances on each side. We pair them up at the end of the month. And wherever the net difference is, there's a payment offset. So if we lease more fibers from Chelan or from Douglas than they do, we'll pay up the difference at their established rates. Vice versa, they'll compensate us at our rates for those services. So it provides operational efficiency and redundancy at a cost savings. And the other unique thing about this is when we need it, it's readily available for quick turn up and quick turn down. So sometimes we'll put up a temporary path on Douglas' side to provide some resiliency. So it allows us a lot of capacity and capability in providing some resiliency in our network. We do it for dark fiber primarily, but we also do what we call lit services, active services. So it's a really great way to share infrastructure between the two counties without having to actually go into each other's county and build redundancy or expand a cable fiber plant in our county at our expense.
I would add the article spoke volumes about our ability to work with our neighbors collaboratively and share that information with the public.
Yep.
Really valuable.
Yep. It's really a great relationship. Started way back in 2001, and we've made value of it ever since, and we'll continue. It's going through the last steps of the legal review and approval process, so we'll be coming back most likely to the board for approval.
You'll probably get hung up with legal. You know, I know Eric.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. I'd like to invite Sam Dilley up. This is going to be an update, construction update on the Tumwater Dam maintenance, I would call it.
Good morning, Commissioner. Sam Dilley, Project Manager. This is an update on the Tumwater Foundation maintenance project. As you recall, last month we were here with a resolution to bid and award that project. During outreach last year to perform the project, we estimated about $2.5 to $4 million to construct the project. With the bid opening, bids came in. We had two bidders. One, the lowest responsive bid was $4.56 million. We looked at the project. The scope is the bare bones minimum necessary to ensure that the dam remains stable and in place. We didn't see any way that we could rebid this project and lower those costs, and we did go ahead and make the award for the $4.56 million. One of the things that we do want to reiterate is, per the board's request last year, you had asked the staff to develop a long-term plan for Tumwater Dam, and staff is in the process of doing a long-term plan for it this year. Natural Resources will identify milestones in the next decades that will inform the continued use of the dam. Are there any questions?
I would just add that this is all O&M. We do expect to have dollars in the budget to cover that. And I think Sam is repeating a common theme that just construction costs are coming in higher and higher on everything, and we're seeing that.
Sam, when after awarding that,
When will that project begin?
The construction window is anticipated to start about September 15th, okay. And our permits go through March 15th of 2024.
Great. Thank you.
Don't always hit these right, but this is a great, great fall to do that mm-hmm. work in the water with the low water that we expect around the time frame that'll start. And sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't.
When do the salmon start running upstream?
they are.
I saw you sitting back there. I couldn't have to help myself.
I'm gonna phone a friend.
Good lifeline, right?
Yeah.
So the salmon are already running. Actually, this
Alina, we all know you, but
sorry, Alina Underwood, Director of Natural Resources. The sockeye already there. That's primarily what's running now. And the permit for this work contemplates work starting in the beginning of September. Most of the adult fish will be returned by then, although we will have some steelhead that are still kind of making their returns. But unfortunately, there aren't very many. So, but the permit will allow us to do work in September.
Fishing just opened up today, didn't it?
Up there? Is it today or Wednesday? Yes, this week.
And they're allowing keepers, aren't they, up in Lake Wenatchee?
Yes, several.
As the locals love the fishing.
We're glad they're there.
Okay. Any other questions?
I just had a curiosity. As someone who lives down on the icicle, it just seemed like the water was high and then it just dropped quickly. Is that observation the same as what's occurring up on the Wenatchee, or?
So the watershed this year is wasn't great, with runoff. Mm-hmm. I was up looking at the project and preparing to do the work this year. We had a fantastic, strong early runoff when I was mm-hmm. there. We were literally seeing spray up over the dam and just everywhere. By the time I showed up and did the walkthrough with the prospective bidders, it had diminished to very low flows.
Yeah.
So just an interesting year,
a
unique year. And as Kirk mentioned, that provides the opportunity for our contractor to get in there with these extremely low flows and do work uninhibited until we start to see the fall runoff or fall precipitation.
Yeah.
So
great.
We're looking to make a strong effort early.
Thank you for that.
Okay. Any other questions for Sam?
Thank you.
Good update.
That's all I have. Oh. Sorry.
That's all right. So we're down to commission items. But commissioners, at the beginning of the meeting, not to preempt any other commission items at all, I gave all of you a copy of a PUD Association survey recognizing that the association is going through the search process for a new executive director, and I'm going to, and Gary at some point here will be able to provide more knowledge than I have, but I'm the current president, so I'll start the conversation and we'll go from there. But we were asked at the last board meeting, at the association meeting over on the peninsula, to go back to our utilities and provide input for the executive committee, of which, as I said, Gary is part of, as to what we wanted to see in a new executive director for the association, which, as you who've been around our commissioners long enough, many of you have, to know that automatically precipitated a long conversation there on the spot. Individuals wanted to provide their input then and there. And, I just kept saying at that meeting that, I'm going to go back to my commission and I'm going to ask for their input, not my input, and I actually even said to those commissioners who are jealous of us because there's five on our commission and two of us can talk together, I said, this is one of those times when two people talking together really does no good. We need all of us to provide a collective input and vision for what we think the next executive director of the association should have for the betterment of public power in the state of Washington. So I'm not going to go through this entire questionnaire here, but I'd like to sort of tee up a conversation about key points that we would like to share with the Association Executive Committee that we would like to see in our next executive director. And I've asked Rebecca if she would capture whatever we come up with and get that provided, the feedback provided to the association. I've also asked Kirk if he would be willing to be, quote, part of that conversation, because Kirk's part of the manager committee. We have staff throughout the district that are involved with various aspects. Eric, part of the legal community, and does presentations. So I just want to start the conversation. And Gary, I think you're probably more prepared than anybody to lead off, because you saw this questionnaire and it probably sparked the creative juices. Your initial thoughts?
Well, I'm struggling just a little bit, because being on the executive board, I don't want to. I feel like I should really recuse myself from the conversation, even, because I'll be involved in a conversation there.
Point well taken. Yeah. Then I'll shoot at McKenna next.
So I have a lot of trust with the executive committee on they'll do a great job, but I just reinforce the new director needs to continue the work of the organization to protect public power, just an overarching drive to advocate for that in the legislative arena, somebody that has shown knowledge and skills to be able to do that. And then my second component of that was a process question or desire to, you know, we have very talented people that have been, I don't want to say promoted, but have been encouraged to develop their skills and prepare for such a position, but that position be posted and advertised, and that internal candidates be provided the opportunity, as with any other candidate, on an equal basis. There's somebody internally is not given any more credence to or preference to an outside candidate, that we're looking for the best candidate for the organization, internal or out, external, and that be part of the process. So those were the only two thoughts I had.
Okay. Kelly, do you have any thoughts?
Regarding the new executive director, I would actually like to see somebody who has experience with hydro in particular. I feel like we have a very unique set of needs and concerns moving forward. And my concern is that having an executive director that wants to look at, to lump all the utilities together without being able to have some sort of discernment on how certain decisions might have negative impacts and consequences to the hydros. That makes sense. I feel like the hydro has to be 100% at the forefront in conversations moving forward.
Interesting feedback. I'm going to point at you, Kirk, because I asked you to be prepared to give. You already shared with us something, feedback you provided the association. So
yeah, I'd be happy to share that too. And first, I would say this is some of our associations are going through this same process all at the same time, and we just APPA just went through a process hiring their new chief executive officer I'm on a steering committee for a large public power council who's starting the succession planning for the president position, and then the PUD Association is all going through this. So, and I have provided input in each of those cases, all three of them, in terms of what I think is important for the leaders of these trade associations that are so important to us. And I thought you brought up a great point, Commissioner Allen, in that depending on which of those trade associations there are, there's different interests amongst those. And it's quite common to have that dilemma, if you will, that how do we represent policy positions where there's different interests among members? And so I do think that is important. Things that I shared from the managers committee was that importance of having solid business leadership and management acumen. I think no matter what, you have to have that solid management acumen from a number of perspectives. One, you have to lead a staff, and you have to be able to motivate staff and make sure that the staff is carrying out the business for the association for the members. So I think that's one of those fundamental things that's hard to teach. And so I think whoever it is needs to come with that demonstrated ability to scale. And what I mean by that, and I've shared this with each of the trade associations where I was able to provide input, was it's the volume and velocity of change is increasing exponentially. And we see that in our industry right now as it goes through a transformation. And so the days of being able to do what you do the way you do it for year after year after year have changed dramatically. And so, you know, a leader of any of these trade associations needs to be able to swing up and down with the activity, because the activity does get quite heavy at times in terms of the number of things we're trying to accomplish as an association and as an industry or react to. So they really, you know, it used to be maybe you'd look at the swings and the volume of velocity changing over multiple years. It's now happening within the year on a regular basis. Along with that, the need to be proactive is going to be critical for the next executive director. There's just, because of the amount of changes that are happening, there's no way to react fast enough. You have to be actually in a proactive position to be able to shape policy and influence before things become policy and then you're reacting to them. Mm-hmm. Collaborative will be really important. I think credibility will be significantly important. And to just put a finer point on the credibility side, I think it's going to be really important for the association and the executive director to be very data driven. There's a lot of things that are happening in our industry, and it's really, really important to have data to substantiate a policy position. And so I think that's going to be really important. And then demonstrated experience in policy advocacy. I think particularly the ability to, and any time you have these positions that come up for associations, there's always the dilemma of, does that candidate have to live in Olympia or Washington, D.C.? And, you know, what I've shared with the other trade associations is they should be able to be in those places a lot. Maybe not necessarily live there as a requirement, but they should be able to be there and be responsive to anything happening in Olympia or Washington, D.C., and in this case, more Olympia than anything. But I would tend to not try and limit the applicants to somebody that has to live in Olympia, but make it a requirement that they have to be there a lot, particularly during the session. So those are and I also supported the internal and external recruitment. I think it's really important for any of our, this is just a critical time for our industry, and just have to do the due diligence to make sure we get the very best executive director that's out there, and allow the internal candidate or candidates to apply, as well as survey the field out there and try and find the very best person to lead that association.
Can I ask Gary, a question?
Kirk, your last comment was well placed, and can you share with me the perspective of the managers group for doing a search and spending the money to do a search. Was that something supported broadly across the manager group?
Yeah, it was. It was a fair amount of talk about that, actually, the manager's committee, is to take the time to do what's necessary to do that very thorough process. And a recruitment effort is something that there seemed to be support for. There also seemed to be support for looking at the salary of the executive director as well, depending on the qualifications. And, you know, it's harder for some utilities to increase their dues, but I think I would say that there was a lot of discussion about recognizing that this is a critical time for a critical association. And if it meant that we had to have more discussion about revisiting due structure, I think I wouldn't go so far as to say it was unanimous support, but there was recognition that that topic needed to be discussed further.
Thank you.
That's, Kirk, you've raised a really interesting point that I want to ask a couple of questions about. And that has, as it relates, what we as commissioners have seen over the last many years is our executive director has done an outstanding job in many arenas and was last year the first dues increase we've had since George has been executive director, Gary, or do you recall?
Yeah, I think that was it.
And he's been executive director for 8 or 9 years. And he's been some perception of some commissioners, this is a bad way to put it, but squeezing the resources of the association, saying we can do more with less. I've had feedback here that our water, wastewater people have felt the loss of John Counts, and you're nodding your head. Eric's nodding his head. And is this the moment, you know, maybe we do have to separate the hiring of the executive director from that big picture view of the association, but there's an opportunity to do them both at the same time, it seems like. But that would require maybe a joint meeting of the board and the manager's committee. Because I'm hearing something different from this manager, and then maybe there's more managers willing to raise dues than there are commissioners.
I would maybe add a little bit of color to that point, and this is again something I've shared with each of our associations, is it's a real challenge right now to find experienced people in some of our key positions. And so, you know, we belong to associations because they represent collective membership. And this is actually one of those times where I think we ought to be, if we don't look at, you know, very closely at expanding what our associations can do for us as members, then each individual utility is going to handle that on their own to some extent. And so to the extent, and it's very difficult right now to find those, that kind of experience. So an association can handle that for its collective membership. You think about it, it's more efficient to do it that way rather than every utility trying to do their own thing and the costs associated with doing trying to hire their own policy person, if you will. So I do think it's one that this is the time where it's critical to actually look at our associations and how we can really get the most from them. And I do think that it's always great to be efficient and try and do more with less. At some point, you can drive efficiencies to a point where it's counterproductive too. And so I think there's that fine line there where you have to really recognize that what are the times that are changing that would dictate a different approach. And so I do think that's for our associations, these are the times where it's hard to find that experience, and our associations could be doing more efficiently for all of its members.
I don't know how to capture this conversation, and I'm praying that Rebecca has a good idea.
It's recorded.
It is recorded. but well, of course, and we have an advantage, and I'm going to rely heavily on Gary, because Gary heard this entire conversation as a part of the executive committee. And so very definitely second the notion that we need to make sure that the association hires the best person that will fit this. One thing that I didn't hear say, and I recognize our association is not, there's 8 employees. Is that about the right number?
It's about the right number, yeah.
And so that's a very different culture than 800 employees. And that the relationship within the culture of a small group is key to success of that organization. And so that new person coming in, whomever it may end up being, is going to have to be keenly aware of individuals and how they work well together, and how, I mean, that's a critical component of success. That entire team has to be successful. And I'm not saying that not all 800 of our employees need to be successful. They do, but it's much easier to, should be much easier to accomplish with a solid team of 8 with fewer outliers. So, anyways, maybe Rebecca and I can get together and talk about how we want to provide that feedback. Okay. If that's okay with the rest of you.
Mm-hmm.
Good input on your part. I would not have thought specifically on the hydro side, but that's a biggie. It really is. Okay.
Can I make a comment on
commission
items? So this is totally separate from what was just discussed.
We are now officially on commission items.
Okay. I just want to call attention to, since our previous board meeting, there was a WAPUTA meeting that took place at the invitation of Kitsap PUD over in Kitsap. And at that meeting, one of our very own was given the floor for several hours to talk about our successful fiber program. That's Bob. And Bob did an excellent job. I just want to call him out for that, because several people came up to me after your presentation, Bob, and had questions, and as well as very kind comments about how well that you spoke and how much information they garnered from your talk. So, job well done. Thank you, Bob. Appreciate that. Additionally, I'd like to report to the board that just last week there was a APPA policymakers summer fly-in back in Washington, D.C., which I attended. And the culmination of that was 8 meetings with our legislators on what day was that? It's all blurring together. I think it was Wednesday or maybe Thursday. Jeff Hall and I and Bill Gordon were the only 3 Washington Mafia that were in attendance at that meeting. So we had 8 offices to call on in one day, which was a little bit of a whirlwind going back and forth. Very hot, and I was wearing a suit, and I was sweating profusely between the Senate and Congress, but we made it work. And the takeaway from all that was a very, very successful meeting with all of our legislators. And I will be circling back here with Kirk at some point. We have a new legislator back there, that young lady who is just a whippersnapper, got a lot of energy, but you can tell she could probably use some help on the hydro topic. So we relayed this already to APPA. APPA has got her on their radar screen to go out and give her some more education. But it's something I think we could also help with, and she would be most grateful, I think. So anyway, meetings all went very well, and we came away from that with, I think, some real positive feedback from our legislators that I'll also be sharing with Kirk at a later breakfast meeting. So just wanted to report back to the board.
Great. Other commissioner items?
Yes, sir. So I had the good fortune of going to the YMCA's reveal, and it was well attended. The Goodfellows, Steve Goodfellow, is offering through the end of this month to match an additional $500,000 for any donations that come in. So if you are wanting to, I encourage you. July 31st is the last. They were very thankful and spoke highly of our staff and the different, you know, the many times you went to the table, I would say. It came up often, and they felt very pleased that they were able to get you down, get us down in price. But it was great. I'm glad I could attend that. Last week, while you were having your fun in D.C. where it was so hot, I was in Boise for the Pacific Northwest Economic Region Summit. And I know we have not attended that before or have a real record, but it's something that I think we need to have on our radar. Members from the International Joint Commission were there, which I'm just now coming into awareness of. And by the way, there's a vacancy on that commission. So it was a lot of panel discussions between Canada and the U.S., over economic challenges as well as opportunities coming up. Energy was a prime topic, though. There's no way to get away from the impacts that the whole decarbonization is having on the country, both countries and worldwide. A lot of focus on minerals and what is going to be done in the United States to get to those very specialized minerals. The Defense Department was there, Homeland Security. We had representatives from many states. Kirk came by and he got to meet Senator Cuff, who had a huge history with the Columbia River Treaty. So it was pretty fascinating. And then there were both the government affairs agent representatives from Grant and Douglas counties present. So amongst many, I think it was about 500 people there. But one thing you guys may not know, these invasive species come on land as well as in the water. So a big thing are the feral swine that are at the border. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, I'm going to put together a little report for all of you. It was very worthwhile, and I want to thank you for allowing me to attend.
Lastly, the first item that I wanted to share was just an appreciation for our staff up in Leavenworth this last weekend when we had the outage at downtown. That is a tough. I really got to learn how tough an environment is that they're working down in these vaults. It's 200 degrees. They did some checking. The fire department did some checking on how much heat is down in these vaults where the failure occurred. And so there's a big challenge there that the PUD is going to be facing with the city on, you know, those faults have occurred several times and we've got some long-term issues. But just to thank staff for and recognize their efforts of getting that electricity back on for those downtown businesses was a Herculean effort. And also want to thank Bob and Jennifer, kind of piggyback on the presentation. I serve as the co-chair of that education committee, and they educated our commissioners, did a great job and got a lot of great feedback on that. And then lastly, from my own learning, the tour that we went on at Kitsap on the new technology for sewage treatment was fascinating.
Yes.
And, you know, at the end when they turned the spigot on water that's drinkable coming out of that, I did not volunteer to drink that yellowish looking liquid, but it is impressive to see. I mean, it just was nothing like I've seen before. So
Deborah drank it, though, didn't she?
Who did?
Did Deborah?
I don't think so. I didn't see anybody step up. But it is a really impressive to see sewage coming in. I mean, it just was it was not like anything I've seen before. So provided a great deal of hope for me. And, anyway, it was fascinating. So great. Great conference, great meeting, a lot of learning on my part, and again, thanks to our staff for helping learning increase for fellow commissioners. Thank you.
Well, everybody stole just about all my thunder, but I will share with you that that sewer tour re-inspired me to reconnect more closely with Ron Slabaugh and find out what's going on in our development on our Dryden sewer, because they passed around this little round disc of what looks like plastic, and it's the membrane that the sewage goes through. I got more than just the policy side, but the practical side. Very interested in what we're doing at Dryden, so I will reconnect with Ron that way. But it also reminded me that for those who aren't aware, and there's most probably are by this time, but maybe not, the genesis of the Tri-Commission group that gets together on a regular basis, the Port, County Commissioners, PUD Commissioners, was three commissioners, Keith Gaynor, J.C. Baldwin, and Randy Smith, that got together about 16 years ago because we had a common interest, and that was the Peshaston sewer. So we've been talking sewer for 16 years, and it's probably not going anywhere. And so that's just a little history lesson in and of itself. So it was a great 3 days over there, and in spite of the fact the difficulty in getting there, it's fun to go on a ferry, but not when you have to sit in line for an hour. But it's a lot longer to sit in line in Tacoma traffic for 2 hours, and I made a mistake going home because it took 2 hours from the Tacoma Narrows to Interstate 90. It was just traffic jam for . It was ugly. Anyway, that was great. I think I'm done with my commission items. Anybody else? Follow up on delegation of action items?
I don't have any updates on prior meetings for item 16. I do have one action item captured today, and that was for Eric to describe the increased demand charge over the authorized limits for rate schedule 36.
And you all have that in your inbox.
So. Oh, cool.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very efficient. Mr. Efficient, I think that's why he's called that.
Oh, I'm not sure that was intended as genuine when it was given to me.
Any additional public comment? Any other matters of general business as may necessarily come before the commission before we go into executive session or recess to come back into executive session? One of the two, we can do either way. So might be easier to recess now and come back at 1:45 or 1:00 and go from there.
We do have staff here for one item.
Okay, then we can in that case, I'll make an executive decision, and we will move into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCWs, to consider the selection of a site or the acquisition of real estate by lease or purchase when public knowledge regarding such consideration would cause a likelihood of increased price as authorized by the RCWs, and to consider the minimum price at which real estate will be offered for sale or lease when public knowledge regarding such consideration would cause the likelihood of a decreased price as authorized by the RCW. For 90 minutes approximately, and I'm anticipating that we will only take this first item and then recess and reconvene back into executive session at 1:00.
Sounds good.
Thanks.
We are coming out of executive session. It is approximately 2:03. We've been in executive session for an hour and a half with a break in the middle for lunch. No decisions were made, no votes were taken. Is there any other business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we stand adjourned.